Non-human animals. So far, we've just looked at whether the average human life is better than nothing. But in order to assess whether the world as a whole is good on balance, and whether it's getting better, we need to look more widely than this. In particular, we've not yet discussed the vast majority of sentient beings on this planet, non-human animals. We'll start with farmed animals. As of 2018, there were more than 79 billion vertebrate land animals killed for food every year. Of these, there were 69 billion adult chickens, 3 billion baby male chicks, 3 billion ducks, 1.5 billion quail, 1.5 billion pigs, 922 million rabbits and hares, 656 million turkeys, 574 million sheep, 479 million goats, and 302 million cattle. In addition, around 100 billion fish are slaughtered in fish farms every year. The suffering we inflict on these animals is difficult to overstate. Chickens, who make up the vast majority of land animals killed for food, probably suffer most. Chickens raised for meat, called broiler chickens, are bred to grow so quickly that by the end of their life, 30% have moderate to severe walking problems. When they're big enough to be slaughtered, most broiler chickens are hung upside down by their legs, their heads are passed through electrified water, and then finally, their throats are cut. Millions of chickens survive this, only to finally die when they are submerged in scalding water, in a step of the process meant to loosen their feathers. Egg-laying chickens likely suffer even more, starting the moment they hatch. Male chicks are useless to the egg industry and are therefore culled as soon as they're born. They are either gassed, ground up, or thrown into the garbage, where they either die of thirst or suffocate to death. But compared to the suffering that awaits female chicks, the culled male chicks may be the fortunate ones. Once grown, many hens are confined to battery cages smaller than a letter-sized piece of paper. Egg-laying hens are prone to peck other hens, which in some cases ends up in cannibalism. To prevent this, a hot blade or infrared light is used to slice off the tips of female chicks' extremely sensitive beaks. After enduring mutilation as chicks and intense confinement as adults, many egg-laying hens nearing the end of their productive lives are subjected to forced molting. They are starved for 2 weeks until they lose a quarter of their body weight, at which point their bodies start another egg-laying cycle. Once they become so unproductive as to be unprofitable, they are gassed or sent to a slaughterhouse. Farmed cattle and pigs have better lives than this, but they still suffer much unnecessary pain. Pigs are castrated and have their tails amputated, and farmed cattle are castrated, dehorned, and branded with a hot iron, all without anaesthetic. Female pigs and dairy cows endure artificial insemination, which is painful and invasive, at least once a year. After that, things only get worse for them. During pregnancy, the overwhelming majority of female pigs are confined to gestation crates, so small they can't turn around. Female cows in industrial farms are subjected to mechanized milking for 10 out of 12 months of the year, before they're spent and slaughtered at around 5 years old. Their male calves, of no use to the dairy industry, are sold to veal factories, where they're kept in tiny stalls and, in many countries, tethered to the wall for the entirety of their short lives. Farmed fish also suffer terribly. Fish farms are very overcrowded. Salmon, which are around 75 centimeters long, can be given the space equivalent of just a bathtub of water each. This overcrowding precludes natural behavior and leads to injury and premature death. Mortality in fish farms ranges from 15% to 80%. Atlantic salmon and rainbow trout are starved for several days, sometimes for 2 weeks or more, to empty the gut before slaughter. Most farmed fish are killed by being left to asphyxiate slowly to death, which can take more than an hour. Others are gassed with carbon dioxide or have their gills cut while still conscious. Putting this all together, it seems hard to resist the conclusion that when a factory farmed chicken, pig, or fish dies, that's the best thing that's happened to them. I know of few people who've studied the issue intensively and disagree. In totality, industrial farming consists in the efficient, society-wide production of a monstrous volume of suffering. The question of what weight to give to human interests and to non-human animal interests is difficult. Humans are literally outweighed by farmed animals. Land-based farmed animals have 70% more biomass than all humans. Land-based farm animals also outnumber humans greatly, by a factor of 3 to 1, with 25 billion chickens, 1.5 billion cattle, 1 billion sheep, and 1 billion pigs alive at any one time. Farmed fish outnumber us, at a very rough estimate, 10 to 1, with around 100 billion farmed fish alive at any one time. However, these species do not all have equal capacity for well-being, and it's hard to believe that capacity for well-being does not matter at all when comparing the interests of different species. Accounting for differences in capacity for well-being does not entail that other species have lower moral status than humans. Rather, it gives their well-being equal weight, but recognizes that some species simply have less of it than others. To capture the importance of differences in capacity for well-being, we could, as a very rough heuristic, weight animals' interests by the number of neurons they have. The motivating thought behind weighting by neurons is that, since we know that conscious experience of pain is the result of activity in certain neurons in the brain, then it should not matter more that the neurons are divided up among 400 chickens rather than present in one human. If we do this, then a beetle with 50,000 neurons would have very little capacity for well-being. Honeybees with 960,000 neurons would count a little more. Chickens with 200 million neurons count a lot more, and humans with over 80 billion neurons count the most. This gives a very different picture than looking solely at numbers of animals. By neuron count, humans outweigh all farmed animals, including farmed fish, by a factor of 30 to 1. This was very surprising to me. Before looking into this, I hadn't appreciated just how great the difference in brain size is between human beings and non-human animals. If, however, we allow neuron count as a rough proxy, we get the conclusion that the total weighted interests of farmland animals are fairly small compared to that of humans, though their well-being is decisively negative. This does not yet resolve whether the welfare of humans and farmed animals combined is negative. Even though, in totality, farmed animals may have fewer neurons, the vast majority of farmed animals, chicken and fish, live lives full of intense suffering, which could well outweigh total human well-being. If the intensity of the suffering of chickens and fish is at least 40 times the intensity of average human happiness, then the combined well-being of humans and farmed animals is negative. Next, we can turn to assessing the lives of animals in the wild. When we try to weigh the well-being of wild animals by their number or neuron count, we get the conclusion that our overall views should be almost entirely driven by our views on fish. The biomass of human beings is 5 times larger than the biomass of all wild birds, reptiles, and mammals combined, and humans have 3 times as many neurons. But the biomass of fish is 10 times larger than that of humans, and there are at least 10,000 times as many fish as human beings. Most of these are tiny fish weighing a few grams that live 200 to 1,000 meters below the ocean surface. Although these fish each only have around 20 million neurons, conservative calculations suggest that, by neuron count, fish outweigh humans by at least a factor of 17. How good is the life of a wild fish? It's easy to have a rosy picture of life in the wild, as being in pleasant harmony with the earth. But Tennyson's line about nature red in tooth and claw is more accurate. While some adult fish species can live for decades, more than 90% of fish larvae die mere days after hatching, eaten, starved, or suffocated. Those that make it to adulthood may suffer from diseases, fungal, bacterial, and viral infections, just as humans do. And the vast majority of adult fish will die not of old age, but will instead suffocate as a result of an algal bloom, or be killed by parasites, or die of exhaustion after building their nest or releasing their eggs, or be torn apart or swallowed whole, then crushed in a predator's esophagus. It's common to think of the experiences of wild animals as part of a circle of life that is at best a miracle of nature, and at worst, just part of the natural order. But while many people ignore the pain of animals in the wild, we feel sympathy and even outrage when animals are injured or killed as a result of human intervention. In my view, there's no good reason for this. A turtle ripped apart by a killer whale experiences no less pain than one strangled by the plastic loops that held together a six-pack. Overall, do the lives of wild animals involve more suffering than joy? Put another way, if you were given the option on your deathbed to be reincarnated as a randomly selected animal in the wild, would you do so? I really don't know if I would. It's very hard to make confident inferences about the well-being of wild animals, given that their physiologies and lives are so different from our own. Overall, it's at best highly unclear, given what we currently know, whether wild animals have positive well-being or not. Our overall assessment of the lives of animals is therefore fairly pessimistic. Farmed animals probably have lives of negative well-being on average. For wild animals, it's unclear, but their lives may well be negative on average too. Next, we should ask, are the lives of non-human animals improving over time or getting worse? The trend is clearly negative for farmed animals. The number of animals raised for food is growing very rapidly, with consumption increasing fastest among chicken and pigs, which, as we've seen, have among the worst lives. The well-being of animals raised for consumption is getting worse over time too, as we develop ever more efficient methods for turning feed into meat. In particular, selective breeding means that modern chickens now grow unnaturally quickly and to unnaturally large sizes. This means that they suffer from a range of skeletal disorders and deformities, are often crippled later in life, and may be chronically hungry because of food restrictions. Some countries have improved their animal welfare laws, but that is a small effect compared to these other factors. In spite of all of this, our attitudes towards animals have clearly improved over the last few hundred years, which could provide some hope for the future. The trend for wild animals is less clear. Human expansion means that the biomass of wild land mammals has decreased by a factor of 7 compared to pre-human times, mostly due to the megafaunal extinctions I discussed in Chapter 2. The biomass of commercially caught predatory fish has declined dramatically, but this has been to some extent offset by an increase in the biomass of smaller prey fish. On balance, various studies suggest that human activity over the last 40 years has probably decreased vertebrate and invertebrate populations, though the evidence is limited and somewhat conflicting. How you evaluate this depends on your view on wild animal well-being. It's very natural and intuitive to think of humans' impact on wild animal life as a great moral loss. But if we assess the lives of wild animals as being worse than nothing on average, which I think is plausible, though uncertain, then we arrive at the dizzying conclusion that from the perspective of the wild animals themselves, the enormous growth and expansion of Homo sapiens has been a good thing. Non-well-being goods. So far, we've looked at trends in well-being of both human beings and non-human animals. You might think that well-being is all that matters morally. This is the view that, after philosophical reflection, I find most plausible. Other things can be valuable or disvaluable instrumentally, but only insofar as they ultimately impact the well-being of sentient creatures. But philosophers are split on this issue. Many would reject the idea that only well-being is of moral value and claim that there are things that can make the world better or worse, even if they are not good or bad, for any sentient creature. For example, philosopher G.E. Moore claimed that natural or artistic beauty is good regardless of whether people appreciate it. Many environmentalists think that ecosystems being allowed to run their natural course is a good thing in and of itself, irrespective of the well-being of the individual animals that live and die in those ecosystems. Given the difficulty of ethics and, as I argued in the last chapter, the need for us to acknowledge moral uncertainty, we should consider the trend in non-well-being goods. Unfortunately, it is hard to make robust arguments that establish what things are valuable over and above their effects on well-being. This is an area of ethics where we may be able to do no better than have our intuitions about fundamental values butt against each other. Some possibilities that many people find compelling, in addition to great art in the natural environment, are democracy, equality, the spread of knowledge, and great human accomplishments. It's not clear whether the trend of non-well-being goods has increased or decreased over time. In terms of the natural environment, the trend looks negative. We have cut down 1/3 of the world's forests. Global forest area continues to decline, but there is some cause for optimism, The rate of forest loss peaked in the 1980s and has been declining since then. Since 1500, we've lost around 0.5% to 1% of the world's vertebrate species. This is a rate of species loss that is much faster than the background rate of extinction, and that meets or exceeds the rate during the Earth's five mass extinction events. The trend in other non-well-being goods seems positive, however. We have made transformative scientific discoveries, such as general relativity, quantum mechanics, and the theory of natural selection. We now know the age of the Earth and the universe. And we have achieved some amazing things. Smallpox has been eradicated. We have climbed the highest mountains in the world, seen the tops of clouds from the vantage of powered flight, and photographed the Earth from space. In 1900, 90% of the global population lived under autocratic rule. Today, more than half of people live in democracies. Even the picture of global inequality is improving. Although global inequality increased from 1800 until the 1970s, since then it has steeply declined, thanks to rapid economic growth in Asia. Because art is so subjective, it is nigh on impossible to assess trends in artistic accomplishment. But one often neglected factor is that, because of our sheer numbers, the artistic output of our species has increased dramatically. A higher population means more artists. And the artistic capacity of the population has, in some respects, greatly increased because of rising literacy and greater wealth. A more literate population has more writers, and the fewer people that are in dire poverty, the more artists there will be. In light of these considerations, it is likely that art has progressively reached new heights over time and will continue to do so, at least for the next 100 years. The same applies for other non-well-being goods. The more people there are and the higher living standards are, the more likely it is that there will be individuals like Usain Bolt, Margaret Atwood, or Mariam Mazzocane who go on to achieve great things. How you evaluate these trends depends on the weight you put on non-well-being bads, like destruction of the environment, and on goods, like democracy and scientific progress. How to make this trade-off is a difficult question, and it's the sort of issue where it's hard for moral philosophy to provide illumination. My personal view is that the overall trend is positive. The case for optimism. So far, I have examined whether the world has been getting better or worse over time. This has turned out to be fiendishly difficult. For all this, we now come to a harder task, to ascertain whether the world will get better or worse in the long run. We can make some progress by focusing on just two extreme scenarios, the best or worst possible futures, utopia and anti-utopia. I call the worst possible world anti-utopia because dystopia does not typically capture how bad the worst possible futures could be. For example, the dystopian scenarios that I envisaged in Chapter 4 and that are often discussed in science fiction would be bad, but they are optimized for things like the worship of the leader or the creation of a society in line with the leader's ideology, rather than to be as bad as possible. Does considering these two possible futures give us grounds for optimism or pessimism? This depends on two things: the relative value of these worlds and how likely we are to realize them. The relative value of these worlds gives grounds for pessimism. In my view, the badness of the worst possible world is much greater than the goodness of the best possible world. To make this intuitive, suppose you are faced with two options. The first is a gamble that gives you a 50% chance of creating the best possible utopia for the future, with a huge civilization consisting of the most flourishing possible lives, and a 50% chance of the worst possible anti-utopia, with a huge civilization consisting of lives suffering the most intense possible torment. The second option is to decline the gamble. If you do so, humanity will dwindle and then go extinct over the coming centuries. What would you do? If the answer isn't clear, then consider just your own life. Imagine that you personally had the option of dying peacefully or a 50-50 chance of living in either utopia, with the highest heights of flourishing, or anti-utopia, with the deepest trenches of misery. I would certainly choose to die peacefully rather than to take the gamble, and I suspect that most people are the same. It's not totally clear how to explain this intuition. Perhaps the intuitive asymmetry between happiness and suffering is due to nothing more than a fact of our biological makeup. As it happens, it is easier to produce pain than pleasure, So the worst experiences that we can possibly feel are much worse than the best experiences we can possibly feel. This asymmetry can potentially be explained on evolutionary grounds. From an evolutionary perspective, the downside of dying is much worse than the upside from eating a meal, say, or from a single act of sexual intercourse. So it would make sense that we would be far more strongly incentivized through pain to turn away from circumstances that might risk our death than we would be incentivized to turn towards a good, like a meal or sex. Perhaps then, when we consider the best possible life or worst possible life, our imagination simply fails us. We just don't properly comprehend what the best possible life would be like. This gets some support from reflecting on peak experiences, the very best moments in life, and how we would trade such moments off against one another. That is, just what time span of experiencing the very worst moment would we accept in exchange for getting to experience the very best moments for a certain duration? For example, philosopher Bertrand Russell, in the prologue to his autobiography, wrote, "I have sought love because it brings ecstasy. Ecstasy so great that I would often have sacrificed all the rest of life for the few hours of this joy." The Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky described his experiences with epilepsy as follows. "For several instants, I experience a happiness that is impossible in an ordinary state, and of which other people have no conception. I feel full harmony in myself and in the whole world, and the feeling is so strong and sweet that for a few seconds of such bliss, one could give up 10 years of life, perhaps all of life. I felt that heaven descended to earth and swallowed me. I really attained God and was imbued with him. All of you healthy people don't even suspect what happiness is. That happiness that we epileptics experience for a second before an attack." If Dostoevsky is right, most people simply don't know how good life can be. However, it might also be the case that the asymmetry is not just a product of our ignorance or our biology, but is more deeply rooted in morality itself. Indeed, on a range of views in moral philosophy, we should weight one unit of pain more than one unit of pleasure. We already saw one possible route to this asymmetry in Chapter 8. I argued that when we are morally uncertain, we should adopt a critical level view, according to which a life needs to be sufficiently good for the person living it in order for the person's existence to make the world a better place. If this is correct, then in order to make the expected value of the future positive, the future not only needs to have more goods than bads, it needs to have considerably more goods than bads. Overall, it seems to me we should think that the badness of the worst possible future is greater than the goodness of the best possible future. This brings us to the second question. How likely is it, relatively, that we will end up in utopia rather than anti-utopia? While my answer to the first question was pessimistic, I think there are grounds for optimism on the second. The key argument for optimism about the future concerns an asymmetry in the motivation of future people. Namely, people sometimes produce good things just because the things are good, but people rarely produce bad things just because they are bad. People often do things because they believe that these things are good for themselves, or good for others, or good for the world. So, for example, if someone spends their time traveling the world, or eating delicious food, or playing video games, we can explain this behavior simply by noting that these things are good. Similarly, if someone engages in social activism, we can explain this behavior by noting that they believe it will make the world better. In contrast, if we know that someone is undergoing a painful tooth operation, it's extraordinarily unlikely that they are doing this simply in order to have a bad time. Rather, the bad experience is a necessary evil in order to avoid more pain later on. In general, even the worst atrocities typically have been committed, not simply because they are bad, but as a side effect of other actions or as a means to some other end. In an earlier section of this chapter, I described the suffering people currently inflict on non-human animals. People don't do this because they actively like the suffering of animals. Rather, they like the taste of meat, want it cheaply, and aren't particularly concerned about the welfare of farmed animals. So they are willing to allow the suffering of animals to persist as a side effect. The same applies for other horrors that have been inflicted throughout history. Most people kept slaves, not in order to make them suffer, but in order to profit from their work or as a status symbol. Wars are, in general, fought not in order to make the aggressor's opponents feel pain, but to gain power and glory. Sadly, this is not always true, and sadism has at times been widespread. Ordinary people thronged to see the gladiators in ancient Rome and to see gruesome public executions in early modern Europe. Moreover, some of the most influential figures in history have taken pleasure in the suffering of their victims. Mao gave detailed instructions when ordering the torture and murder of millions of his victims, and he took pleasure in watching acts of torture. Similarly, Hitler gave specific instructions for some of the plotters of the 1944 assassination attempt to be strangled with piano wire, and their agonizing deaths were filmed. According to Albert Speer, the Minister of Armaments and War Production in Nazi Germany, Hitler loved the film and had it shown over and over again. But even in these cases, part of the motivation for these sadistic acts might have been to maintain power and signal status. Although they are there in the population as a whole, malevolent, sadistic, or psychopathic actors may be disproportionately likely to gain political power. Many dictators have exhibited such traits aside from Mao and Hitler, including Genghis Khan, Saddam Hussein, Stalin, Mussolini, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, François Duvalier, Nicolae Ceausescu, Idi Amin, and Pol Pot. There is therefore a risk that malevolent people could have an outsized impact on the future. Despite these important and worrying exceptions, in general people are much more often motivated to promote that which they believe to be good than that which they believe to be bad. We see this motivational asymmetry in current global expenditures. Most spending is on the pursuit of things that are good: health, science, education, entertainment, and shelter. Only a small fraction of global expenditure is on imprisonment, war, factory farming, or other evils. And these are almost always done as a means to some other end. This asymmetry in motivations is clear when we think about potential pathways to the best and worst possible futures. First, consider the best possible future. Civilization is full of beings with long, blissful, and flourishing lives, full of artistic and scientific accomplishment, expanded across the cosmos. We can come up with ready explanations of how such a civilization might arise. A first explanation would invoke moral convergence. People in the future might have just recognized what is good and worked to promote the good. That is, over time and with the enormous scientific and technological advances that the future might bring, including advances in the ability to reflect and reason with one another, everyone might have converged on a vision of what the best possible future is like and then put it into practice. Second, even without moral convergence, people might have worked out their own visions of what a good life and good society consists of, and cooperated and traded in order to build a society that is sufficiently good for everyone. The resulting society would be a compromise among different worldviews in which everyone gets most of what they want. Even if no one has a positive moral vision at all, but just wants what's best for them, this could still result in a very good world. In a world where communication, trade, and compromise are easy, and technology is extremely advanced, most people could get most of what they want. Now, try to consider the worst possible civilization, one that is as bad as the best possible future is good. Such a future would have to consist of an enormous number of people spread out across the cosmos, living lives full of intense misery. Can we come up with explanations of how such an outcome could come about? It's much harder to do so. Realistic dystopian scenarios are usually optimized for some other end, not to make the world as bad as possible. So astronomically good futures seem eminently possible, whereas astronomically bad futures seem very unlikely. The badness of anti-utopia is greater than the goodness of utopia, but utopia is much more likely than anti-utopia. All things considered, it seems to me that the greater likelihood of utopia is the bigger consideration. This gives us some reason to think the expected value of the future is positive. We have grounds for hope.